You're listening to Honestly Aging by Friends Life Care Vigor, a podcast where we explore what it's like getting older, the peaks, the valleys, and everything in between. In this season of Honestly Aging by Friends Life Care Vigor, we're covering topics related to solo aging. I'm your host, Cheryl Proska. Let's grow old together. On today's episode, I'm joined by Fred Dawson. Throughout his career and life, Fred has reinvented himself again and again. Fred spent his first career with the DuPont Company as a professional engineer in various engineering assignments. Moving on, he started his own consulting company and then had a third career in architectural design and building residential homes. Now in his retirement, Fred's discovered his passion for writing. Fred is also a Friends Life Care member. Fred, welcome and thank you for being here. How are you today?
Well, it's a pleasure, Cheryl. Thank you so much for the opportunity.
Absolutely.
And Linda, my care coordinator, sitting next to me here, she might hold my hand from time to time, part of her job description.
And yes, a big thank you to our care coordinator, Linda Natto, who helped organize all of this. You may have seen her in our podcast we did a few months ago about spirituality and aging. So if you haven't checked that out, please go back and do so. As for today, though, Fred, you are joining me to discuss the power of reinventing yourself, which you have done many times. We'll cover your life and career transitions, overcoming obstacles, lessons learned, and advice anyone can use on a journey of reinvention. Before we delve into the topic of self-reinvention, I'd like to give you the opportunity, though, to tell us a bit about yourself.
Okay, thank you. Yes, I was born in Wilmington, in a part of the city that was called Union Park Gardens, which was a row house community built for the shipbuilders in World War I. So the houses were all tiny, but there were parks all around. It was a very nice and a beautiful place to live and to grow up. I had two older brothers and a grandmother that lived with us, which of course was very common back then. We didn't have a bedroom for her. She slept on a day bed in a dining room. But she had a third grade education, but she was so wise and I learned so much from her. We didn't have life care back in those days, so that was very, very common. My best friend had an aunt who was totally deaf that lived with them. So that was the way it was back then. As I said, I had two older brothers, and we had a family of six in an 850-square-foot house. My father worked for the railroad. They were very smart. They didn't lay people off. They reduced hours. So at his lowest level, he was at two days a week. I have this image in front of me right now of my parents sitting in front of their desk every payday, trying to figure out what bills they could pay and what bills they couldn't pay. That the depression is an imprint. That tape recorder runs all the time. And everyone of my age has that same experience. I went to the old Wilmington High School downtown Delaware Avenue. It's, long gone now. And after the paper routine when I was younger, I had a job at the DuPont office buildings delivering mail at 3 to 6 every afternoon. And that was really great. Just walk right down Delaware Avenue. And it was so fun at seeing everybody every day. I did well in school. I loved math and science. I didn't do too well in history and languages were a disaster. Logic and was a good thing. Memory was a bad thing. I just was not blessed ever with a good memory. One more thing. As an oddity, I did take art as an elective all through high school. it doesn't seem to go with math and science. And I was not a good artist, but I was always very interested and fascinated with the aesthetic world. Then on to University of Delaware as a commuter. I was in a school of engineering and graduated in 1952. And in the carpool the second year, this cute girl joined our carpool. And I didn't know until many years later that she told her mother when she went home that first night that she had met the guy she was going to marry. So you women, you tricked the men into thinking they're making these decisions. I didn't stand a chance. When I graduated in 1952, the world was in turmoil with the Cold War. And you could have as many job offers as you took interviews. I had seven and got tired. But I did take a job with the DuPont Company, and they were the designers and builders and operators of a plant in South Carolina that made atomic fuels for the atomic bomb and the hydrogen bomb. So that's how I started my career. There were 38,000 construction workers working seven 10-hour days. The plant site was 365 square miles. They moved towns and cemeteries. And it was pretty scary for a 21-year-old kid, I'll tell you. I was in a startup team of starting out four nuclear reactors. And remember, this was in the 50s, so there wasn't very much of that back then. Another byproduct of the nuclear reaction was a form of hydrogen, which was very unstable, had two extra neutrons. And the name was tritium. And it so happened that I just somehow became one of the four shift supervisors that started up tritium in the history of man. Now, the course of research and pilot plants and all that were done before, and this was production. But even so, it was very, very challenging. I used to tell my grandkids that if I touched a light bulb, it would glow.
And such a big responsibility for someone in their 20s. You were overseeing individuals who were far older than you and with something so serious. So that, speaking about the imprints that you were talking about, I would think that must have left an imprint on you.
Yeah, well, yes, it was. It was because it was the first time that things were being done. You know, we weren't inventing, that was done before us, but the implementation was for the first time. So it was very challenging. And I learned so much in such a very short period of time. But then we were overstaffed for the startup, of course. And then there were a lot of transfers. And I was one of the transfers. And I ended up back home in the Central Engineering Department. And of course, my wife was from Wilmington also. So there we were, both returning home. But we didn't want to accept the transfer because we lived in the tiny little town of Aiken, South Carolina. And we loved it very, very much there. It was so much, there were so many people just our same age and in the same situation that we were in. But back home we went, and I didn't really like the Central Engineering Department nearly as, well, of course, nowhere near as exciting as what I had just been through. And I discovered that the company was rather old in its view of things. And it was an expert engineering department. Don't get me wrong. Their expertise was well known throughout the whole country. That's how they got the job to build the plant down in South Carolina. But for me, it was old-fashioned and it wasn't creative enough. And I just wasn't very happy. I was designing one plant after another and repeating and doing the same thing over and over again. But I had three kids at the time. So guess what? I stayed. Mm-hmm. Then an interesting thing, I changed a tire for an elderly woman on a bridge in a very difficult situation. And she was so thankful. And riding home, I thought, I've got to do something more worthwhile in my life than what I'm doing. And as a child, I dreamed of being a doctor. So I said, well, I'm going to be a doctor. And my wife was very courageous. She said she would go back to work and we would find a way to do it. And I went to Temple University and met with the professors and we created a plan. And I took night courses. But then all of a sudden, I took that chemistry course, pre-meds take, chemical engineers take, and research scientists take. I got a 14 out of 100 on the first test.
Mm.
So I went to see the professor. I said, what's going on? Here I had achieved my professional engineering license at the time. Here I am, a practicing engineer, and I got a 14 on the test. Now, true enough, the maximum on the test was probably 30 or 40 or something. But even so, he said, you can't take a course like this. This is not for an engineer. You're trying to figure things out. You have to get flashcards and put one side of the equation, one side of flashcard, and the other side of the equation, and the other side of flashcard. And you have to live in a dorm, and you have to flash these cards at each other from breakfast till supper until you go to bed. So he was right. I was spinning electrons around in my brain trying to figure out how these atoms were going to combine. So, oh boy, what a shock that was to me. But it was a good thing that to have happened. So then, you know, what am I going to do about this? Well, I just drifted into volunteer work. So I was extremely active in the 60s and 70s in a lot of social concerns programs in the inner city. I was going to Methodist Church at the time, and they had a program called MAP, the Methodist Action Program, and in conjunction with Joint Council of Christians and Jews, I was extremely active through the 60s and 70s. I was, you know, averaging out one or two nights a week and many weekends and conferencing. We did some amazing things, prenatal care, postnatal care, you know, kitchens and dining rooms and GED tutoring and landlord-tenant tutoring and just on and on. And it was so rewarding and I learned so much. But then something happened at my DuPont that saved me. We got a computer. The computer weighed tons. It was water-cooled. It can't do as much as your cell phone can do today. But we were able to start to do some computer-aided engineering applications. Aha, creativity.
Mm-hmm.
So I got into that, and off of project work, was a full-time worker in that field. And I did develop some expertise, and I entertained a lot of consultants that were coming in to help us. I got to know them pretty well because I didn't drink. So my bosses knew that. And then I would take them out to dinner and get them back safely. So I got familiar with the consulting field. And I said, oh, I'm going to quit and be a consultant. So I waited till I was 50 and qualified for pension. And then I started up my own consulting firm. I knew how to do consulting from the other side of the desk, true enough, but still I knew the field. But what I did not know was how to market myself. I didn't have a clue. I tried cold calls. That was the biggest waste of time in the world. I did not bring a penny into my family for 6 months. And then I remembered the old engineering idea that you cannot keep doing the same thing over and over again and expect a different result. Well, I got to do something different. So I started writing papers and presenting them to conferences. And oh my gosh, go where the market is. Go where the interest is. I was overwhelmed. In the next few years, I doubled my DuPont salary, and for 2 years, I tripled my DuPont salary. I was working myself to death, however. It was very, very hard. Flying everywhere, working with people that you don't know. I learned a lot about group dynamics. Also, back when I was doing consulting work, you know, First thing is you have to figure out who has the power, who has the pens. And then I got good at classifying questions. There's a pure question of seeking information. That's rare. A question that leads, it's not a question. It's a statement, phrases a question, and so on and so on. So it was necessary to survive, to observe all these things. And then when a vice president, somebody at the higher level, would come in and join us, and the questions changed. I know as much as he does. The questions were as impressive as how smart you were. So it was difficult, a very difficult job. And I would be writing reports on the airplane coming back, sitting up until 3 o'clock in the morning, finishing reports. My wife would be taking them off to a typist the next day, and I would be off to Philadelphia to the airport to go to another job. I was eating a lot of fancy food. I had to, because the dinners became business meetings. No exercise. I weighed 265 pounds, and naturally, I'm usually pretty slim. I said I couldn't, not only could I not tie my shoes, I couldn't see my shoes. So I said, I got to quit this job. It's going to kill me. Well, wait a minute. I took art as an elective in high school. I designed my own house that I'm living in now. So I'm going to stop this consulting. I didn't like it. There was no product. It had no feely touchy about it. You know, I was gathering information and rearranging it and presenting it, but there was very little value added. So here I am again with a second career that I don't like, and not even good for my health. So I'm going to stay home and build some houses. Well, the engineering carried through that. That was not a problem. Actually, designing and building residential homes is pretty easy compared to what I was involved in designing and building chemical plants, you know, from an engineering point of view. But there was a lot to learn in technique and application. But I picked that up real quickly in architecture and design. And oh my gosh, I loved it. You start off with a few lines on a piece of paper, and you have these wonderful, talented people to work with, and you end up with a house. What could be better? I always said I didn't build custom houses because everybody did that. I built personal houses. I never told my clients what to do. I gave them options with pros and cons, and they selected the option, because I always said to myself, I'm not going to live in that house. They are. So we really had a lot of fun doing joint projects. And but also, I jumped ahead a little bit. I also had a problem there too in the beginning, similar to the previous one, of marketing myself, and in this case, getting jobs. Finding a way to, I didn't have the finances really to do, I wanted to do contract houses. So anyway, I had saved a fair amount of money from consulting. I had done well. I lost all that money I had saved in the first 2 years of building houses. You know, about the starting curve? I can tell you, it is real. I lived it. And one of my daughters said, Dad, what are you doing with our inheritance? But I caught on real quickly, and I did well eventually. But in anything that you think you can do something, but you have to be aware that other people ahead of you that have been doing it for 30, 40 years might know just a little bit more about it than you do.
Would you prefer to age independently in your own home or live in a nursing facility? I know what I'd rather do. Friends Life Care membership offers just that. Plan today for a future lived at home with vitality, independence, growth, and resilience while protecting your savings. Learn about your options at a free seminar or webinar. Register at friendslifecare.org/register or call 215-628-8964. What stood out to me is what a profound level of self-awareness you've had throughout your entire life, from childhood, knowing where your strengths were, but also finding ways to challenge yourself and get creativity and exciting points involved. And then something that this generation of workers struggles with is that health and work balance. And the fact that you were able to recognize that the consulting job was affecting your health and knowing you had to make a change and taking the risk to change it, that's so admirable. And I know so many people in a similar position to that. So it's just so interesting for me to hear about what you went through in your life and be able to compare it to what people in my stage of life in the current day are going through.
Yeah, I think you had a later question, but this addresses it now. This is going to sound like a very strange thing when I say it, but I never was concerned, never worried about making a mistake. I never made a mistake. Now, my dream and my project that I was working could have been a disaster, but I learned. Mm-hmm. So I did not make a mistake by trying. My oldest son gave me a very great compliment. We had four kids with driver's licenses, and my wife and I, so we had a family with six driver's licenses. So I bought old junker cars because I knew the kids were going to wreck them. And I didn't want to yell at them. That meant that there was a lot of maintenance to be done. So my oldest son and I, we did everything. Swapped engines. And, oh, my gosh, we did everything. And he said, as an adult, he said, "Dad, you were never a very good mechanic," which was true. "But you taught us it was all right to try." I think that's one of the biggest compliments I ever got in my life, really. So there's that feature of not worrying about making a mistake. Another part of that was our director of the Methodist Action Program in my volunteer days always used to say, "It is impossible to do nothing." Hmm. To do nothing is a strong, positive action to support the status quo. And I took from that, it's better to do something, even if it's wrong, than to do nothing. Because it's impossible to do nothing. You learn. And so what Robert Frost said, the best way out is through. Hmm. I like that quote.
So considering your varied career, professional engineer to consulting to architectural design and building, how did you discover talents you didn't even know that you had?
I did not discover them. They were just there all the time. I think I've experienced in many phases of my life, what's inside comes out. I suppose Somerset Maugham had that as kind of one of his things in all his books. What's inside comes out. And in his books of You and Bondage and all this, his point was under stress. We were going to read some of my stories later. Mm-hmm. But I have a very short one that is appropriate to what we're discussing right now, if I may read it.
Of course.
It's entitled My Father's Story. After a visit to see my grandmother Dawson in City Hall, Philadelphia, where she was employed, my father often told this story. Being too small to hold his hand, I grasped his finger and pulled him to the foot of two curved ascending stairs. One had marble treads badly worn, and the other wood replacements. I asked, "Why are the treads different?" an engineer at an early age, perhaps four. I don't like the predestination theory. I must prefer freedom of choice. Evidence, I fear, suggests limited freedom. What's inside comes out. And during my lifetime, as I would often, to discover my programming, I would often ask myself questions and critique the answers. And then a quote I always liked, the great use of your life is to spend it on something that will outlast it. So I think an awful lot of talent is in the gene pool. And then, of course, you add to that through the two types of learning, acquired and experiential. You might, you know, top them off and hone them a bit, but they are there from the beginning.
And it's, I have a young son, so I'm constantly trying to figure out how to harness all of his creativity and things that I can just start noticing that he is talented at. And I'm always trying to figure out ways to just help him come into his own a little bit more. So everything you've been talking about right now is making me think of him and that relationship I'm trying to foster within my own home.
Yeah. Wonderful, yeah. Freedom, freedom of thought and spirit. My wife was so good at that. All the children grew up as free spirits. Two of them are running their own businesses now. I have four children. I didn't mention any.
So I think you've covered some of this, but I wanted to see if there was anything else you'd like to touch on about some of the challenges that you faced during your life and your career transitions, and how were you able to overcome them?
I think I know what happiness is. You seek pleasure, and an emotional state appears called happiness. But being an emotion, it doesn't last long, and then you have to seek pleasure again over and over again. I was never very interested in happiness in that sense. I think I was just born content. What is contentment? I don't know. It's hard to even define what contentment is. But I think I was just lucky enough to be born with it.
What I'm processing from what you're saying is that while I'm thinking about a fire, and I'm thinking about that happiness might be those points where you add on another match or stoke the fire and it gets so bright. However, another emotion or something can happen and put the whole fire out, where contentment would be the ability to keep the fire burning all the time, and then having these peaks and valleys, and just knowing how to handle all of that, contentment would probably come into play.
Yes, I think so. It's just a steadiness. My wife always said I was boring because I did many highs and lows.
You're always safe.
You're always the same. You're boring.
You were steady, Fred. So. A theme that keeps coming up throughout this conversation is your ability to problem solve. Can you give us some more examples of some problem solvings that you have done that you're particularly proud of?
Well, I'm not proud. I don't know if I'm proud of them or not. Some of them are funny. When I was a teenager, I had a puppy, and he was a male boy, and he wouldn't learn to lift his leg. So I tied a string on his leg and took him for a walk. And whenever he came to a tree, I pulled the string. And it worked. On a more serious note, thinking back to when I was a child, I mentioned that we lived in a very small row house. And it had a front porch. And the neighbor had a front porch. And the woman who lived there was a recluse and was very jealous of my mother for having a family that loved her. And she on her porch and my mother on her porch. And the woman was saying very, very bad things to my mother. My mother was crying. I was 12. I know that because I was on my way out to serve my first newspaper route. And without any forethought or any plan, I just yelled, "Hey, Mom, come in here a minute. I need your help." So she came in and I said, "Don't go back out there." So, you know, it's just sometimes you don't plan things. It just happens.
Mm-hmm.
Another part of problem solving, I think, is perspective. I thought of this morning when I woke up, thinking about this interview coming. But you know, your brain doesn't stop working when you're asleep. It's going full force. Mm. When my eyes flew open this morning, I thought of problem solving, and it's like an umbrella. The umbrella, the canopy, the material is perspective. It's the canopy, like the star canopy. The problem is the broken strut inside of the umbrella. So I always thought that perspective was a very, very important element of problem solving. I always wanted to know where things fit. When a DuPont engineering, some of the guys I worked with, would get irritated with me because one time said, "You have to start with the universe and then the Milky Way and then the solar system. Come on, get down to Earth here and solve this problem." But I always had to know how things fit together as part of my problem solving. An example of that, a friend called me. He was trying to rebuild the front stoop on his house, and he was struggling with how many steps and how many risers. "Come on over here, friend, look at this with me." So he's going through all his thoughts of what, "Oh, I could do this, I could do that, I could do that." I said, "Let's go out and stand on the street for a minute and look at your house." "I don't want to go out on the street. Come on. What do you want to go out there for?" Well, we ended up doing a very modest earth movement and adjusting the terrain, and he had no steps. So that's what I mean about perspective. Sometimes it's very important in problem solving to step back and take a look.
If I might, I feel like you have the inspiration for your next poem with everything you just said about perspective and how it plays into problem solving. And I just loved the visual you were creating for us with the umbrella and the stars as the canopy. So I think that may be your next greatest work.
Write that down.
Yes. Take some notes. So going through a life so well lived, how have you leveraged your past experiences and skills going through the times that you've been reinventing yourself?
I don't know how to answer that question, frankly. The engineering was a constant through all.
Mm-hmm.
All the endeavors had that in common. But I don't know about leverage, because that takes me back to the startup curves. There wasn't much leverage.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone was risky and exciting and an entity unto itself, unto its own. My wife used to say that I looked at life with my head tilted on one side and my eyes were squinted, and I countered and said that she did the same thing, except worse than me. That again is an expression of perspective. And there's a saying there that creativity is only limited by your imagination. And another quote: "Those that dream only at night don't accomplish very much. Those that dream during the day change the world."
Hmm.
As you see, I like quotes. My kids are tired of living their lives with me with quotes. "Why do you like quotes so much, Dad?" I said, "Because I'm not smart enough to think about myself."
There's no new idea. So, Fred, what advice might you have on embracing change throughout life's journey?
And we've been talking about it all along, is just the steadiness, the confidence, the contentment to see me through, not being afraid of making a mistake, because I never make a mistake. I'm repeating what we said before, but this is the best advice I think that I could ever give anyone. You always learn. You know, it's impossible to do nothing. And so, you know, if I can use some engineering language, get off your butt and get to work.
You've shared with me that you're in your 90s and you consider 90 to be the new 70. Can you tell us what is it like to be aging and how have you responded to it?
I find it exciting, actually. I really, you know, my brain says to do something and my body says, do what? Have you lost your mind? And I do play games with words. I don't like the word acceptance. I know I'm supposed to like the word acceptance because you're supposed to accept things before you can overcome. But to me, acceptance is negative. I much prefer the word alternatives. I don't like the word limitation. I don't want to feel limited. I've not come up with a good synonym for that. Maybe boundaries is better because I could sneak through a boundary once in a while. And my biggest boundary, my biggest penetration to my boundary now is to call one of my sons to come help me. You deserve this. I took care of you for 21 years. Now it's your turn.
Yeah.
But what else? Oh, I have had, you know, 90-year-old problems. I've had over 20 surgeries. I spend a lot of time at the junkyard looking for parts.
Wow.
But that's of no consequence. You get through those things. They're part of, I do have a little bit of a concern sometimes that medical science has exceeded evolution's plans and preparations. I think we're living longer than intended.
Yeah.
And that's why we do have these problems.
I know around this time of our talk, we wanted to switch gears a little bit. And I wanted to ask for you to share a sample of your writings. And I know that you write some short stories as well as some poems, and they're lovely, the ones that I've heard. And I would just really appreciate if you could share them with our audience.
Okay. Thank you. I would love to. The very first poem I ever wrote, and I had no idea I could write a poem. By the way, my poems do not rhyme, but my daughter-in-law, who's very good at this, says, it's okay. Your poems don't have to rhyme. They're still poems. So this one is entitled Places. I have a place. A secret garden. It's not far, a pause away. A bench is there, moss and ferns, and a chipmunk at play. A lotus pond and a frog or two, and birds that sing. Flowering of trees stirred in the breeze. With sunlight and shadows, a newborn fawn still. Orchids and mystery, and birds that sing. A bench big enough for two in my garden. Before, during, and after my stay, it's not far a pause away. So that's the very first poem I ever wrote. I've only written about six is all. I have to wait for inspiration to wake creativity. You can't program creativity. You just have to, you're giving me a hint for today though. That's good. I have something else I'd like to read. It's a little bit long. Do we have time still?
We do.
Oh, good. Okay. This one is kind of a life story in a way. It's entitled My Community. My daughter asked, what is the most significant change you have experienced in your 90-year lifetime? Without pause, I said, the change from community first to self first. Primitive man had many survival challenges, but he did know the man across the village who made the kill this week, and the woman next door who dug the wonderful tubers. Sharing was not an option. It was a survival. Community first was not intended. It was a given. And then the primitive Eskimo story. When consumption exceeded production, the elderly would walk away from the village, sit down on an ice floe, and fall asleep. I think I would say, I'm getting cold, I'm going back. Now let's fast forward to when I was a child. I lived in the city. Walking down my street, a voice came from somewhere. Pull your hood up, Freddy. It's cold today. I knew the ice man, the milkman, the bread man, the huckster, all by name. And the best of all, Joe the mailman. When a letter finally came from my brother in China during World War II, Joe didn't put it in our box. He rang the doorbell and rejoiced with my mother. During the Depression, we had a hobo camp nearby. They would make a list, warm socks, long underwear, and my oldest brother rang doorbells. Oh, someone is sick. Out came the soup pot, and I delivered. My father shopped at the farmer's market. He knew the names, and the butcher, and the rabbi, and everyone knew everyone. I was a tag-along, breathing in. Let's fast forward again. I need some groceries. I jump in my car, and I drive down the road, each built by hundreds of people, but I do not know them. There are red lights along the way, and I wait for my neighbors to pass, but I do not know them. I arrive at the shopping center and my favorite store, built by hundreds of people, but I do not know them. I select some beautiful tomatoes, grown by a farmer, picked by pickers, delivered by truckers, displayed by retailers, but I do not know them. Or I go to my computer and order it online. And so many services just for me. I turn on a wall switch, behold, light. I open a faucet, behold, water. My mail is delivered, my waste is removed, my kids go to school in new clothes and go to a park or a museum and public transportation, all prepared for me by hundreds and hundreds of people, but I do not know them. They have no faces, they have no names. I'm confused. What happened to the insurance man who came to our house once a week and collected a nickel premium and sat and talked about his family? A veil has dropped. Opaqueness is hard to see through. If not careful, I may think nothing is there and I am an individual. And even worse, I act like one. But if I pause thoughtfully, I know my community is still there, supporting my every move. I cannot lift the veil of modernism, but perhaps I can peek through and say thank you to my community. I cannot survive without you. And I owe my daughter an apology for an inappropriate answer to her question. Although self first is in full display, my community is still number one. Signed, an explorer of consciousness. And a quote, you cannot shake hands with a clenched fist. Indira Gandhi. So that's, you know, how my life has changed in one respect.
And I think that's, I think a lot of people have gone through the same thing. And when you were talking about the veil has dropped, it made me think about how, especially with social media, it has given the ability for people to show only what they want about themselves. And that's coming up for me as a type of veil that you're talking about.
Sure. Yeah.
Fred, what are you working on now?
My wife's story at the request of my children. She had a very interesting life. She started out on a dairy farm up until about 5 or 6, no electricity, no plumbing, and so forth. And so just starting that, it's hard because it brings back memories. Do we have time for any more poems?
Sure. Yes, absolutely.
This one is kind of a serious one. It's called My Journey. I am born, energy and materials borrowed. My arena sustaining, work, play, and family. A brief time circle, the continuum in all. My surroundings abiding, embracing the dance. I will return what is borrowed, my spirit soaring, with hope of little lost and dreams of a little gained, questions unanswered, but a warmth and a glow, stars as my witness, harmony, signed, a guest thus invited. Another one that ties in with the perspective that we've been talking about quite a bit, and this is kind of weird, I guess, but I think it's creative. I like it. It's entitled Shapes. I am the sun, sustenance for all. I am a patch of moss clinging to a stream. I am a blade of grass bending in the wind. I am a tree majestic, reaching for the sky. I am an ant following directions. I am a serpent, mythological for many. I am a bird set free in flight in song. I am four-legged, hunted or hunter. I am two-legged, thoughtfulness and understanding in motion. I am all of these with more time ahead than behind. All is one, one is all, and dreams of sweet melodies. I know it's belief of many religions and certainly Christianity that we are the chosen ones. I don't look at life that way at all. I think the dominant species on Earth is plankton in the oceans and anything green on Earth, and that I'm subservient to those things, and everything is dependent on them.
Well, I did just have a final question for you, if you'd be so inclined. What does it mean to Fred Dawson to reinvent yourself?
The most important thing, I think, in my life is when I was consulting, I gave a lot of speeches, and I put in my speech that I thought I had made it up. The only thing constant is change, and I was very proud of that. Then I was looking through the book, Famous Quotations, Martin's famous quotations that all the politicians refer to and all the preachers refer to. And I discovered that a Greek by the name of Heraclitus had said the same thing in 500 BCE. So my bubble was burst. I was so upset because I thought I had made that up. But I think that is probably one of the most important messages that someone could take from our interview. The only thing constant is change.
Fred, thank you for sharing your personal experiences with self-reinvention and guidance for anyone on a journey of reinvention. It has been an absolute pleasure connecting with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, dear. Appreciate it very much.
Thank you for listening to Honestly Aging by Friends Life Care Vigor, a unique program focused on aging with vitality, independence, growth, and resilience. You can find links and show notes from this episode on our website at friendslifecare.org/podcast. Thank you to Fred Dawson for joining us today. If you like our show, please rate, review, subscribe, and join us next time. To learn more about aging with vitality, independence, growth, and resilience, subscribe to our blog at friendslifecare.org/blog.